Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Today on the 10 Adventures podcast, Karen and I are talking with Jim Kern, a legendary figure in the outdoors, a founder of the Florida Trail, co-founder of the American Hiking Society, and president of Big City Mountaineers. Along the way, he's explored a lot of the most beautiful places on Earth. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So I'm really excited to talk to you. You have this legendary life of just doing these great things. You're working on something really great right now, which is really important. We'll come to that later. But how did you get into the outdoors? You know, what lit your fire to just have a life filled with so much outdoor adventure?
I grew up in a small town near the George Washington Bridge on the New Jersey side. In our town, there might have been 5,000 or 6,000 people. It was a mile square. There was some vacant woods about 2 or 3 blocks away from my house. And it seemed when I was young, it was quite a vast place. In fact, when I grew up, I was surprised to see how small it was. But that woods had a huge effect on my life. And my friends and I used to go into those woods and look for garter snakes and box turtles and build a fort and so on. One day I saw an unusual bird. You know, I saw wood thrushes on my lawn, robins on my lawn, sparrows, blue jays, but this bird was different. It turned out that the superintendent of my elementary school was interested in birds, and she would ask the children. So I was maybe I was in the fifth grade at the time. And she would ask the children if they, as the snow was melting off our lawns in New Jersey, has anybody seen a robin, for example? Well, this time I had a story. I thought I could get some brownie points with the principal of the school. I went in and said, I saw a different bird. And she got out this big book and we looked through it. And it turned out that I had, in fact, seen something. It's called a rose-breasted grosbeak. And that started an interest in birds in that way, identifying, seeing different birds. And about that time, I got into scouting. And I found myself gravitating toward the outdoor merit badges. Those two things happening in my life made a huge difference at that point, at that age in my life. And then when I went off to college, you know, I lost contact with, I didn't have time for birding. I was more interested in girls. And actually, later in my life, I picked up on all kinds of outdoor activities, canoeing, hiking, just taking nature walks. It was always just fun just to take a nature walk.
And so you went on to develop a love of hiking and backpacking as well.
Not backpacking yet. That came later. That's a story I'd like to tell you. When I was in college, I opened the Yale Daily News one morning, and here was a guy holding a jaguar, a photograph of him holding a jaguar, and he was going to show a film. This would have been my sophomore year. He was going to show a film of his adventure in the Mato Grosso of Brazil. Well, I couldn't wait that evening, and I went to the residential college different from my own, and I saw this film. And I thought to myself then, I was in the engineering school, and I thought to myself then, this is what I want to do. So his name was Wyman Carroll. So what began with the rose-breasted grosbeak and getting merit badges in scouting came to this point where I was sort of drifting through college. And this particular evening, I saw an adventure film done by a young man. So I can identify with this. And I say, if he can do it, I can do it. I didn't know he had a private income, by the way. But if he can do it, I can do it. And that was a transformative moment in my life. I remember walking back to my residential college after that program, like on air, like it was a religious conversion. And I decided that I was going to film and collect wild animals around the world somehow, some way. And so, as it turned out, I did that. I had to find a career that made sense, that made real money, because this was going to be a very uneven source of income, poor and irregular. So I got into buying, brokering, and selling vacant Florida land. When you complete a land transaction, there's not much mop-up. There are not a lot of details. Like if you own an apartment, for example, well, shoot, the plumbing in somebody's apartment can easily fail, or somebody can drive a truck in your front lawn or break a window. But vacant land suited perfectly for my idea, because these transactions would come not every week, you hoped every month, but sometimes months would go by, a feast or famine business. And so when I would get the closing, at the closing, I would be handed a sizable check. And with that check, I could pack my bags and go and look for the proboscis monkey or the chromado dragon or the quetzal, and so on, the one-horned Javan rhinoceros. These were unusual, rare, endangered animals, and I wanted to go and find them and photograph them. And so I had a lifetime of doing that. And at the same time, the love of outdoors in my backyard didn't end, and I started hiking and backpacking locally. And so with my spare time, I founded the Florida Trail Association, the Florida Trail, and I went on to be the founding president of the American Hiking Society, as Richard has listed, and other things. That's kind of how it happened.
And I understand that you've also written a book about your love of the outdoors called Trail Reflections.
That's true. That was a coffee table book. It was actually the second book. The first book I did was about 50 years of wildlife photography. And the second coffee table book was really 50 years about hiking and backpacking around the world.
And when you were writing this book, was there a place or two that really brought back a lot of joyful memories for you?
Karen, in doing this, you know, trying to raise a family, trying to pay the mortgage on my house, and trying to get to northern Pakistan to hike to a town called Shimshal, let me tell you, there was a lot of stress everywhere I turned. I seem to be comfortable piling my plate up with stuff. And so things work out, you know. And so now with that in mind, let's go to your question. Special places. Hiking to Shimshal in northern Pakistan, about 5 or 10 miles from the Chinese border. Yeah, that was a terrific place, since I already mentioned that. But I had, yes, I mean, I've hiked in New Zealand, the Milford Tract, a special place that a lot of Americans have gotten to that like hiking. And I've hiked in the Himalayas, in I guess every country in the Himalayas. So I've hiked in Bhutan and Nepal, northern India, Pakistan. Then I've been to the tip of South America. There's a national park in Patagonia, if I can say it correctly in Spanish. It's Torre del Paine. What's the English translation? I'm not even sure. It's a fabulous wild country in that park, and I've hiked there too.
Jim, I'm really interested. You mentioned earlier about founding the Florida Trail, and I never thought of, you know, how a person gets a national scenic trail developed and built. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, how you came up with the idea for the Florida Trail and how you actually made it happen? Because it seems a monumental task from my side.
It is a monumental task, but what happens if you have a good idea and can get the word out, folks will surface with a common interest, and that's what you need. It won't happen without others. I'd like to tell you another story. My father called me after I'd gotten married in South Florida and said, let's plan a vacation that we can both drive to, and it looks like the mountains of North Carolina might be a cool place in the summer, equidistant from northern New Jersey and southern Florida. And so he picked this destination, Nantahala Village, I think was the name of it, and we're going to meet there and enjoy some decent weather. Well, I got there with my bride, and I got bored pretty quickly. they had brought my younger brother, 10 years younger than I, so I was maybe 27, he was maybe 17, still in high school. I said to Rich, let's take a hike on the Appalachian Trail. Well, neither of us had done anything like this before. We had no backpack. We didn't know what would keep us warm at night. We didn't know what food to bring. We didn't know anything. What's a 17-year-old kid going to say to his older brother, 10 years older, if he wants to go on a hike, you know? I talked him into it. So we took the blankets off the bed of the motel. We got some canned food. We wrapped the food up in the blankets. And I got a little map, which was ridiculously small, maybe 8 inches across. And my parents drove us up to Clingman's Dome, the highest point there in the Smoky Mountain National Park. And we set off on this 40-mile hike. I'm going to tell you, Richard, it was a disaster. The first shock I got was coming to a shelter about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And I knew if we stayed at the shelter, we were never going to get to the destination, Fontana Dam, where our parents would meet us. What are we going to do? I figured we've got to go on. But the next shelter was too far away. It was going to get dark and we didn't even have a flashlight. I thought we've got no choice. We've got to keep hiking until the last smidgen of light, and then we're going to lay down and cover ourselves with a blanket. And that's what we did. Now, the problem with that is that the Smokies are called the Smokies for a reason. Heavy clouds waft through the trees. The moisture condenses on leaves, and the water drops off the leaves onto you. And so as the afternoon wore on, we were in damp clothes. And finally, before it got totally dark, it seemed like this cloudy, misty, smoky mountains turned into a clearer sky, but we had a miserable night on the ground, And the next day we completed we stumbled out on the Fontana Dam with basically way beyond sunset and exhausted, wet, our feet were killing us. And there was Fontana Dam, there was a night watchman, and we stumbled in there and said, are there some people waiting for us? And they said, oh, they were here. They waited a long time, but they left. And when we were totally demoralized by that statement, then he said, well, they came in two cars and they left one car, and here are the keys. He let us suffer for several moments before he told us that. So anyway, I do remember to this day, trying to get out of the bed the next day. I could literally not stand up for a minute or two. And then when I stood up, I shuffled slowly, painfully across the floor. That was my introduction to backpacking, July 1961.
Yeah, despite your sore and aching bones and muscles, it seems like you still loved it and you still went on to do lots of different hikes and different outdoor explorations. Now, you were talking about doing those 40 miles on the Appalachian Trail. And you know, most people have heard about the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail, but there are many other national scenic trails that people haven't heard about. And I was just wondering what's holding the others back from becoming more well-known?
That's a very good question. And that gets to a point close to my heart these days. The National Trail Systems Act was passed by Congress in 1968. The only trail that was worthy in those years of being called a National Scenic Trail was the newly completed Appalachian Trail. But the Appalachian Trail had dozens and dozens and dozens of private property owners who had granted them permission to cross their property. Well, as a National Scenic Trail, this had to be linked as one continuous, secure trail. How to do that? Every long, thin corridor of any kind needs something found in the Bill of Rights called eminent domain, the use of eminent domain. Whether it's a new highway, a railroad, a canal, a fiber optics line, it doesn't matter, water line, sewer line. And here's what the Fifth Amendment of the Bill of Rights says. Nor can private property be taken for public use without just compensation. If you go to the Bill of Rights, number 5 in the Bill of Rights, that's half of one sentence. That's the guts of every road and railroad in this country. That's how we get completed corridors. Now, Congress granted the Appalachian Trail eminent domain, and that's how the trail got finished. 700 miles of a 2,100 mile trail were missing in 68 when Congress passed that act. So in the ensuing 30 years, slowly but surely, they bought 2,550 parcels of land that gave them that corridor. Well, you can see that eminent domain is a controversial, very powerful thing that the founders gave to the government. They had the foresight to see that we would need this, you know, and we use it every day. And not just corridors. We use it for school sites. We use it for fire station sites. Two miles from me, the airport is being expanded. We use eminent domain to buy the houses in front of the runway extension. So it's used all the time, but it's controversial. Most of the uses you see fall into the rubric of calling it a utility. Well, now we got to have water. We got to have sewer. How important is a footpath? Well, I think America's rich enough that we can turn to other, not just utilitarian uses. How about medical, environmental? How about health reasons? We know now that hiking is a terrifically inexpensive, democratic, healthful pursuit. So Congress needs to give the other 10 trails what it gave the AT. That's my story. And it hasn't done that.
And does that mean it's a legal battle, or is it a matter of Congress buying the land that those trails occupy?
What Congress does is give eminent domain to an authority. In this case, it could be, let's say, U.S. Park Service. The U.S. Park Service was given eminent domain by Congress for the Appalachian Trail. It could do so again for the other 10 trails. Now, mind you, you've probably assumed, and you assumed correctly, the trails aren't finished. They're not finished because they don't have eminent domain. Now, there are a couple of exceptions. Almost all of the Pacific Crest Trail runs on a crest that was already owned by the government. So about 90%, over 90% of the Pacific Crest Trail can be used. About 10% of it, the hikers don't know this, but about 10% of it is subject to closure. It could be closed. And the Pacific Crest Trail desperately needs Congress to grant eminent domain to finish that. I mean, we'd be shocked if we found out that we lost a couple of big sections of the Florida Trail and now it's a discontinuous trail. You know, how could that happen? Congress would finally have to act, but they should act now because we're calling these national scenic trails. Now, that's the closest to being finished, but the Continental Divide Trail is missing about a third. It's not protected, about a third. The North Country Trail, about a half of the North Country Trail is not protected. My own Florida Trail is missing 300 miles of a 1,300-mile trail. We're trying to buy up pieces now here's my second point. We're trying to buy up pieces as they become available. And the leaders in the hiking community think we can do that. I've produced a book that gives you the data that clearly explains it doesn't work that way for utilities. It's never worked that way for utilities. It's not going to work that way, folks. You have to be granted eminent domain to finish the job. The statistics are in the book. It comes down, here's one statistic that dramatizes what I'm saying. On average, around the country, for every road that U.S. highway that's been built in the last 4 years, one out of every six acquisitions has needed eminent domain. So I ask you, if one out of every six, we've got 2,800 parcels to complete the Florida Trail. How are we going to complete the Florida Trail if one out of every six, for 130,000 acquisitions over 4 years, the highway department had to use eminent domain? How are we going to finish the trail system without eminent domain? You tell me. It's not possible.
Jim, one thing that I'm really passionate about is the ability for the outdoors to bring economic wealth to places that, you know, don't have it. And I look at these national scenic trails and, you know, you look at what the PCT has done and kind of regenerated, you know, lots of small towns adjacent to the trail. You look at the other scenic trails and it can bring tourists who are going to spend money, bring economic growth to kind of, you know, forgotten places. And, you know, just on a financial basis, you know, we can spread wealth to places that aren't, you know, that aren't doing very well as allow people to explore, you know, different places, get to meet different people. You know, tourism is concentrated in a few areas that are really popular. It seems like this can really help just, you know, help people who are struggling to make ends meet, to bring in tourism dollars, as well as all the benefits for the people who are hiking, who are, you know, it's mental health, physical health, you know, build new relationships, reconnect with nature, you know, have introspection. It seems like it's a really, you know, a win-win-win. What's the opposition to doing this? Is it just finding the funds? Is it, you know, who's opposing, you know, completing these scenic trails?
I'm so glad you said this, because I would have eventually gotten around to it, but it's I like it coming from you at this point. Thank you for that. Yeah, and there's something political that I want to insert here. You know, when we talk about trails, it's just a short step to talk about the environment. Now we start to talk to the liberal side of the equation. But you've just brought up something that's a terrific message for the conservative side. In the rural parts of America, the rural parts of Florida, these small towns tend to be conservative. The big cities tend to be liberal. This is something that the conservatives haven't got. Richard, I don't know how to get this message out to the conservative side of the spectrum. These small towns benefit from hikers. The interstate systems go from big city to big city. Trails go from small towns to small towns. The conservative side of the spectrum should be encouraging hiking trails.
It's not just through hikers either. You know, once you get a through hike, people start to come for weekends. You know, when there's a nice trail and all of a sudden, yeah, you have the through hikers, but you also have little towns that start to grow with day trippers, long weekenders. And it is, you know, I think travel is a real incredible way to grow small local businesses. And, you know, I think that's really the lifeblood of any economy. And so you can have these towns populated with hotels that have more occupancy, corner shops, guiding services, outdoor shops, and really bring a lot of small businesses, which is going to provide long-term wealth to regions that, as you said, if you're off the interstate, you've lost, you know, you've lost a lot of your economic activity, and who's driving, you know, the secondary roads anymore? Not many people.
Yep. Absolutely, Richard. Right on.
So what can people do? So, you know, this seems a really rational approach. You know, what's the next step?
Well, that's why I wrote my book. It's called Broken Promise, The Plight of Our National Trails. And the promise, what do I mean by broken promise? Well, in 1968, the passage of the National Trail System Act, the creation of the AT, eminent domain for the Appalachian Trail, the implication was there that this was the beginning of a trail system. And so the promise that's been broken has been the fact that the trails that have been added have not been allowed to be completed the way the AT was completed. And we need to do that. Now, how do we do that? How do we get the story out? How do we tell this story that you and I are talking about right now? The best way I know is with an oversight hearing. Congress has the authority to schedule an oversight hearing on any bill that it wants to, any act that it wants to. So we need an oversight hearing of the 1968 National Trail System Act. That gives an opportunity for people like you and me to go there and tell the story that we're telling here on the air. And so the reason I wanted to end this message, this time together, I wanted to urge people to go to Hiking Trails in America and sign the petition for us. You become a voice asking for the oversight hearing. There has been no oversight hearing in 42 years of the National Trail System Act. It was passed in 68. They had an oversight hearing in 78. And there hasn't been another oversight hearing since. And so that's the platform. That gives us the chance to go and say what you and I are saying this morning.
So signing the petition would be the next option for people who are wanting to get involved and see more development of the National Scenic Trails then.
Right. Would be sign the petition. And then if you have any question about the data that the three of us are talking about this morning, please get my book. Because I say this is all in the public domain, everything I've said. I haven't made anything up. The book has the data in it that reinforces what we're talking about.
Sounds great. And we can link some information about the book in the show notes later in the podcast. One thing that I'm really interested in is the Big City Mountaineers. And my understanding about that is that you help disadvantaged teens by introducing them to the outdoors. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. In 1989, I was living in Miami. My kids, I had twins, 15 years old. I opened the Miami Herald, and here was a full-page ad. One of the airlines was offering a free child's ticket if the adult bought a ticket to one of the following Western cities. So right away, I looked through that ad, and there was Missoula, Montana. And I know there's great hiking out of Missoula, Montana. So I asked one of my boys, Drew, would he like to go hiking and in Missoula, Montana? And he was up for it. He said yes. Well, I knew a friend in real estate that wasn't married but had bought hiking equipment and had never used it. And so I thought, I'm going to ask Jerry if he wants to go hiking, which I did. And he said yes. I said, now, Jerry, here's the hitch. There's an extra ticket, child's ticket, for $1. I can buy a ticket and I can give Drew a chance to invite a friend to go along with us. We're going to go out to Montana. All of this excited him. So, yes, no problem. Let Drew know. So Drew invited a friend. The friend couldn't go. I think maybe mom and dad were concerned about some crazy guy wants to take his son out in bear country in Montana. But anyway, he couldn't go. So I said, we'll ask another friend. So Drew asked another friend. That friend couldn't go. Well, in those days, I had been dating a gal who was the director of something called Teenage Shelter Care. And I called Rebecca and I said, Rebecca, would you have a deserving teenage boy to go backpacking with us? She called me back a couple of days and said she had somebody. The mother was going to, they were in this shelter in downtown. This is for, you know, a relationship that's broken up. There's abuse involved. And the mother has taken the child and gone to this shelter. So the mother wanted to speak to me. So I drove downtown. I had an interview with this lady. And she said she was okay with it. We could take her son. So now we had a foursome, two teens and Jerry and me. And so we went out west and we had a good time. We had a great hike in the Bitterroot Mountains. And here I am with adults and teens. And it just struck me, obvious. I know the hiking community, the backpacking community. I like the people. They're stable. They're responsible. They're mature. The demographics of people who like to hike in the woods is excellent. They're often professional people. So, you know, so now I'm thinking quickly here. Why not? I tell you, this came together in my head in about an hour. Why don't I try to get these kind of hikers together with disadvantaged teens. And that's it. And so I filled in the blanks. We're going to make it 8 days, a day of travel out, a day of orientation, a 5-day backpacking trip to a remote mountain lake, 2 days out, a day there, 2 days back, and a day going home, 8 days. So then I looked around for adults who would go, and I found them. And pretty soon, that next summer, I had a trip put together.
And we had a good time. Fortunately, that first trip could have caused untold grief. And you can imagine if your parents. All right. So instead, it was a good time. And so there it was. I had proven to myself that it could be done. So the next year, there were 3 trips and then 5 trips. And this thing was starting to consume me. I had a board of directors put together, but I was doing all the work. The Big City Mountaineers was literally in my vest pocket. And it was really consuming me. But I was also getting the word out. And there were people providing lots of help. They had the background to provide help. One was a couple, Bill and Mary Kay Stair. They made maps for wilderness hikes. They were living in Colorado at the time. And Mary Kay Stair became the second president after 8 years of Big City Mountaineers. But now we're in 6 cities, I think, since the founding in the next year, 1990. I think we've taken 100,000 kids in the wilderness. It's a fantastic experience. And you know, here's a surprise. What I didn't see coming. The adults that go on these trips find it absolutely as fabulous as the teens do. When do you rub elbows? I'm looking at 2 very lovely people right now. When are you going to rub elbows with some kids from the hood? You tell me. It doesn't happen. You're going to spend 5 days with this kid who's been chosen because he's deserving. This is a gift, a special gift. Everybody's a volunteer. He's been selected, you know, and I should start to say she, because we soon, about 4 or 5 years after the beginning, we had female trips, women and teenage girls, and we had men and boys, and we do that to this day. I talked my lawyer in Miami to going on this trip. And his wife, after the trip, she told me, she said, "I've never seen Paul cry until he came." She met him at the airport. He climbed in and threw his bags in the back. And, you know, the trip's over. And she said, "Well, tell me about the trip." And he couldn't do it without tears. Yeah. It's that kind of a trip.
Jim, hearing that is so inspirational. I'm on the board of the Alpine Club of Canada, and we're trying something similar. It's called Girls on Ice, and it's helping disadvantaged girls get familiar with the outdoors. And you know, we're helping dozens of girls, and to hear you helping hundreds of thousands, it's just such an exciting opportunity to think, you know, in 30 years, can we have done something similar? Because it really is, the outdoors is so transformational. And if you've never been outdoors, you don't even know what you're missing. And for a lot of these children, once they see what the outdoors offer, it really is an area where it's not, you know, it's not limited to affluent people or things like that. You know, anyone can go hiking. It's just, you know, once you're there, you need a pair of shoes and, you know, some fitness. But it's just so beneficial. And, you know, just hearing what you've done is really inspirational.
It seems like you've done so many different things with the outdoors. And I was wondering if, you know, there was one thing that gave you the biggest satisfaction with the impact that you've made.
It would have to be Big City Mountaineers and what's evolving. And, you know, we're continuing to grow. We have become a special project of the outdoor industry. So the outdoor industry, it's called Outdoor Industry Association, OIA. We've captured their heart, I think it's fair to say. And the outdoor industry does a lot to help Big City Mountaineers. It all started with JanSport. It all started with my daughter-in-law stopping by the JanSport booth at an OR show and talking to the founder, Skip Yowell. And Skip Yowell said something to her about, "Well, ask Jim to call me." I called Skip Yowell. He was in Appleton. Their factory was in Appleton, Wisconsin at the time. And Skip said, I think you should come up here to Appleton to talk to us." I got the significance of that, you know. They didn't say, "I'm going to send you a ticket." They just said, "I think you should come up here." And I said, "Let's work out a date," you know, without knowing a thing. I just could read the tea leaves. When they picked me up at the airport, it was about noon. And we went directly to a restaurant, and the restaurant had all these executives, these JanSport executives around the table. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how many of these guys are going to be left when the lunch is over? We go back to the office, or some room, and how many are going to be left? Well, Karen, every one of them was in the room, and I'm thinking to myself, this is going to happen. And they wrote me a check for $100,000. Then I knew that Mary Kay Stair in Evergreen, Colorado, you know, I couldn't dump on her what I was trying to do at the moment. It was just too much. But, you know, now you can hire somebody, one or two people. You can buy the equipment. You don't have to scrounge and so on. I knew we were going to be off and running, and that's, and they stayed with us for ever since the beginning. And the industry slowly has come on board.
You know, Jim, I feel like I'd love to go for a hike with you and just hear these stories for like 8 hours, because we didn't even touch on the American Hiking Society. We didn't even get into the Florida Trail. There's so much more. But I've really loved hearing what we did here. And again, I'm super, super inspired by what you've done with Big City Mountaineers and what you're doing now with hiking trails in America. I'm going to put links to your personal website, to Big City Mountaineers, to the American Hiking Society, the Florida Trail, the Friends of the Florida Trail, and Hiking Trails for America, all in the show notes, and encourage everyone to check this out. If you want to be inspired by what one person can do, you can get a great inspiration by just looking at all you've accomplished. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's just been incredible to hear your stories.
So nice to talk to you, Jim.
Well, it's a treat for me, a privilege for me. Thanks for inviting me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.